kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland welcomes your calls on Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's the Project Censored Show and calls for a mass uprising to stop the Trump regime before it starts. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, the Dirtbag will answer your questions, including, is this cold good for anything in the garden? Thanks you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Night, Kanan.
Night, Jenna.
Night, David.
Night, David.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th at 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Maggots and Men is an experimental film set in post-revolutionary Russia, and it tells the story of the 1921 uprising of the Kronstadt sailors with a subtext of gender anarchy. This film is a benefit for Out There Adventures, whose mission is to cultivate leadership and build community for queer youth through adventure. Again, that's Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th, 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Next Level, a benefit dance party on Saturday, January 21st, after the Women's March, starting at 8 p.m. at the Jade Club in Portland. This 21 and over event features Jen O of Strange Babes, KBOO's DJ Anjali, and Casual Aztec, as well as performances and more. Again, that's Next Level, a benefit dance party on Saturday, January 21st at 8 p.m. at the Jade Club, 315 Southeast 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it's about a couple minutes past 6 here on KBOO Portland Community Radio. Coming up next, we have Preference Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, a transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, or at radiocab.net. Or if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. Smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. Like I said, we have Preference Radio coming up. It is an experiment in queer radio. Our first story is going to be coming out of a program. It's called Out of the Bay, Gay Radio from San Francisco.
Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay. Tonight, the women of San Quentin. We welcome back Norwegian photojournalist Kristin Lissigen, who was our guest after the publication of her first book, The Boy Who Was Not a Lesbian and Other Stories. She's out with another collection of profiles and photographs, this time about the plight of transgender women in male prisons here in the U.S. The Women of San Quentin, Sole Murder of Transgender Women in Male Prisons. Kristin intimately profiles nine transgender women who've been incarcerated in male prisons, being housed with and treated as members of a gender they don't identify with. Surrounded by convicted murderers and rapists, Kristin writes, they're forced to fight for their lives on their way to womanhood inside some of the world's most dangerous prisons for men. She notes that California is home to one of the largest correctional systems in the Western world and consequently one of the largest populations of incarcerated people with gender identity issues. This has many implications, which are detailed by the experiences of the women in the book. Many have been forced to perform sexual acts on other inmates, kept in solitary confinement if they've complained, and been denied access to transition-related health care, even when medically prescribed by a doctor. Tonight, we're happy to have Kristin Lissigen and with also one of the women who shared her story in Kristin's book, Danielle Tavake. Kristin Lissigen, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Thank you.
And Daniela Tavake. Did I say that right?
Yes, Daniela Tavake.
Thank you. Welcome to you, too. Thank you both so much for coming in to talk with us. Chris, first I want to ask you, what got you started on this project? When and how did you know you wanted your next book to be about these women?
Well, I didn't plan to make another book so soon because I had just published The Boy Who Was Not a Lesbian. And then I read a story about Grace from Liberia, who was an immigrant living in San Francisco. And her story about her three deadly attacks in San Francisco, hate crimes towards her because she was a transgender woman and black. When I read the story, I just couldn't believe that I had not thought about that specific topic, because I have been working on transgender topics since 2003, so almost 13 years. But I never ever thought about what happens to people when they end up in prison. So I thought I needed to learn more about this. And the more I learned, the more shocked I became.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you had started working on transgender topics in 2003. What was it that interested you at the time?
Well, I was studying BA photography, and I used to work as a journalist in Norway before that. Then I went out to look for I guess cultures that were very new to me, and I met up with people in the gay street in Birmingham called Her Street, and then there I met a 6'3", very tall, beautiful woman called Michelle, and I asked her if we could meet the next day as Rob, because she identified as a transvestite. And the next day she picked me up as Rob, and that was very, very interesting to me. It was very new.
Mm-hmm. Daniela, how did you hear about what Kristin was doing, and what made you want to contact her and trust a total stranger with your story?
The first time I heard it was through TGI Justice.
TGI Justice, what's that?
It's trans.
The Transgender Justice Project?
Variant intersex.
Okay.
One of the staff members sent me a flyer that Chris put out and asked them to send to the women in prison. And they sent it to me because they figured that it would be something that I would be interested in. And my first instinct is to be a voice for the women that don't have the voice, that to be a part of something that gave us the voice. And so that was my whole backing to it. But then it just opened up to me expressing me for the first time in my life.
As I understand it, Chris, the process with each of the nine women you profiled started with writing letters back and forth.
Yeah.
So tell us how that worked and what you learned from those letters.
Well, I didn't actually go out and look for anybody. So I had the organization in San Francisco, and Janetta Johnson, who is now the director of this organization, and she helped me send out proposals or to send out flyers to people. And so I didn't pick anybody out or anything. They started to write to me very quickly after they got the project proposal. And I kept all the people, I guess, all the people who wrote to me regularly for almost 2.5 years, I sort of included them in the book.
Wow, okay. And now, Daniela, you have an excerpt from one of the letters that you sent to Chris that you can read part of it to us?
Yes.
That would be great. Now, this is written shortly after you were transferred from Corcoran State Prison to Salinas Valley State Prison in July of 2013. Can you tell us, you know, why were you transferred? Was there a reason, or is this kind of something routine that would come along?
I was supposed to be transferred because it was supposed to be a hub for the women that were in jail in transition, and it was supposed to be a place that provided transgender groups, women in transition groups, and it was supposed to be a place where they allowed us to order makeup, feminine clothes, feminine shoes, and it wasn't that place. It wasn't the place that it was supposed to provide for us, and they called it a hub for the girls in prison.
Okay, fantastic. So then if you can read that, please. Thank you.
So I was transferred to this prison, Cork, because Corcoran wasn't an approved prison for transgenders. Well, I was attacked by this guy 3 days after I got out of orientation. I wasn't even in Salinas Valley for 3 weeks before I was sent to the hole. My girlfriend Naomi got into an argument with some guy, and he started calling her a faggot. I asked the guy to stop, and then he started calling me a faggot. Anyways, words were exchanged, and then this a-hole and his friends attacked Naomi and I while we were waiting to be released from the dining hall. We all were sent to the hole for participating in a riot. Naomi and I are supposed to be sent back to the yard after our 115s, which is a rule violation, are heard. I pray they hurry and get this over with. I have not shaved my face in 2 weeks. When I look in the mirror, I want to cry. I am forced to wear a beard. We are supposed to shave with clippers on the yard 3 times a week, but the clippers are broken. Apparently, there will not be new ones for another 3 weeks. I appealed this. The horrible thing is, none of the inmates are even appealing this. I don't understand this. I don't even belong in the hole. I was attacked, and I was the one who has all the injuries. It was written up in my favor, but I still shouldn't even be in this place. They're not investigating the fact that the two men who attacked Naomi and I called us faggots. I can't wait to get out so I can put all this behind me. So moving to this horrible prison has not been good thus far.
Okay, thank you very much. You mentioned the hole a few times. What's the hole?
It's administrative segregation, and it's where people who have broken the rules that require segregation time or for their own safety protect them.
Okay, is that the shoe, what they call that in some cases?
That's security housing unit, and that's long-term.
Okay.
ADSEG is like 3 months or less.
Okay, well, that sounds like an awful long time. How long were you there?
3 months for this incident.
Okay. And when in case that the rules that you had broken were that you had been in a fight, supposedly?
I was defending myself.
No,
I wasn't
I know
in
that,
a fight.
But that's what they interpreted as.
Well, no, we participated in a riot. Mm-hmm. That's how they wrote it up to keep us in there for 90 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's very, you know, a very normal way to punish people, especially trans people.
And what's it like to be in the hole?
23 hours of the day, except for 1 hour for 3 times a week, you are in your cell. So
totally by yourself.
Yes. So for 4 days out of the week, you are in your cell with your cellmate for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And the only time you leave your cell is for a shower or 1 hour of rec, which is in a dog kennel, three times a week for 1 hour.
Okay. Thank you for reading that that section. You were in a few different detention centers of various sorts. Can you tell us, you know, which prisons were worse or which better than others? It sounded like Corcoran was better than this place that was supposed to be. Salinas Valley was supposed to be better for
transit. Okay, Corcoran wasn't better, but it was like the officers didn't really care about us girls. And like Salinas Valley, they focused on us. Mm-hmm. And they would tell us we can't wear earrings. They would tell us we can't wear makeup. They would tell us we can't wear too tight pants. And they would tell us that we can't wear... that we can't alter the male tank tops so that our breasts don't hang out from the side. And it was like this is supposed to be a place where it's a hub where we're supposed to be able to be ourselves freely. And this is the place that was telling us that we couldn't alter the male clothes that they only allowed us to get, so that we would feel feminine and we would have the life experience as living women, as women, which is a federal law. It's not like a state law.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are photojournalist Kristen Lissigan, author of The Women of San Quentin, Soul Murder of Transgender Women in Male Prisons. She's joined by one of the women profiled in that book, Daniela Tavake. Kristen, as bad as Daniela's experiences were, her story is rosy compared to those of the other eight women in the book. Is that fair to say?
Well,
rosy.
I would never use that word.
Not a good word to use. I apologize.
No, it's all right.
I think it's probably much worse than we know. It's probably very hard for us to imagine even what Daniela has been through. The backgrounds of the women are very, very different. Daniela experienced a lot of abuse out in society when she was a child. And also she wasn't she wasn't understood. People didn't want to make an effort to understand who she was. And so for her, she was fortunate to meet someone inside of prison that actually understood her. And so she had a different experience. She was also, I guess, fortunate to meet other trans people and other gay people. But for many people, many trans people, they don't meet other people within the LGBTQI community inside prison.
Sure. So... I want you. You've got another excerpt prepared for us, right, Kristen? This is from.
I answer?
Yeah, please.
The question you just asked. I think the difference between me and a lot of the women that are profiled in the book is I was abused sexually from the age of 4 until the age of 14, and I promised myself at 14 that I would never be a victim. And I was one of the women that was in prison that didn't allow a man to control me and allow a man to take advantage of me. And I would pick up a weapon or I would like physically fight them. And I was like, my reputation preceded me, and I didn't like being this person. Nor did I like being the woman that would fight and known for that. Mm-hmm. But it was something that helped me survive in prison.
Yeah.
It wasn't something I wanted to do. It was something that was of a necessity until I met my current boyfriend. And as my best friend for a whole year before he became my boyfriend, he nurtured that woman, and he taught that woman to be gentle and that it's okay to be, to get your feelings hurt, and it's okay to cry, and it's okay to be feminine and be the woman that I was born to be. So I think that's the difference between me and the women and profiled in this book and their experience in prison. Like, some women is not, it's just not in them to, like,
to fight back or to stand the ground.
Yeah, and it's just, and believe me, it would have been easier to just accept it. And, but it wasn't, like, it wasn't, it was, like, it used to steal my soul. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I want to get back to your story a little bit more in a minute, if you'd like. But I want to ask you, Kristen, about, you said the first time you were allowed into a prison, actually, was when you met Shiloh, whose last name is escaping me right
Quine.
Now. Shiloh Quine, thank you. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about that? And she's famous for her own reason.
She's now, yeah. Well, she doesn't get to see any of that fame at all. And also people are deciding...
Because she's still in prison.
She's still in prison. She's in... One of the reasons why probably she won the settlement with the state or with the Department of Corrections, because now she is going to be the first trans woman to receive surgery and be moved to a female prison or a prison for women. And sorry, now I'm losing it now. Not losing it, but I'm
what losing was your question? Place. Well, do you want to read this? You have a section to read from the book about her, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to read that?
Okay. So she's in prison for she's convicted of murder, because she's in for life without the possibility of parole. Her case was very different from another case where Michelle Northworthy actually did win a settlement also to be allowed to have reassignment surgery, but the Department of Corrections in California let her out on parole instead.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of Shiloh Quine's fondest wishes, she told me in her letters, was to be photographed, since the only photos she had of herself were taken back in the days when she looked like a man. She has been incarcerated for almost 35 of her 55 years, with no visitors during the last 15 of those years. 2 years into our letter correspondence, on a Sunday morning in December 2014, I drove to Mule Creek State Prison to visit Shiloh. It was a strange feeling knowing I would be the first person to visit her in so many years. It would also be my first time inside an American prison. Mule Creek, just outside the town of Ione in Amador County, is a farming and tourist area 2 hours' drive east of the Bay Area. Shiloh and Kenny, her cellmate, had both been transferred there recently. They had written that Mule Creek seemed safer compared to the abuse and hostility they had experienced in other prisons. Despite my dishearteningly unsuccessful attempt to see Ashley Diamond in a Georgia prison 2 months earlier, I felt optimistic. A prison guard had explained on the phone that I did not need an appointment, since I was already approved to visit Shiloh. Still, as it is the way with the prison system, the compound could be on lockdown, and Shiloh did not know I was coming. I had followed the visitor's guide carefully, making sure that I was wearing a bra with no metal, that the bra wouldn't show under my blouse, and that I was dressed in ordinary, non-provocative clothing. I had read about women who, after driving for hundreds of miles and waiting for hours lined up outside the prison, were refused visitation because part of the bra was showing.
You're listening to Preference and Experiment Queer Radio here on KBOO. I'm Alan, your host tonight. Thanks for tuning in. We are listening to an interview with current and former inmates from San Quentin, conducted by Daniela Tavake. It was recorded for Out in the Bay, Gay Radio from San Francisco. And thanks to all the folks who made this possible. We're going to listen to a few more minutes of that, and then we're going to chat with Red. She's a local sex worker activist. She's got a lot to say. There's a City Club forum happening tomorrow. There's a lot happening at the national level, all across the board, local, state, federal. We're going to check in on sex worker safety with Red in about 6 or 8 minutes. Let's go back to this discussion on transgender women in male prisons, the women of San Quentin.
A surprise. There was no line of visitors waiting to get into Mill Creek. I walked into the visitors' processing building where a female officer greeted me and said, "How can I help you today?" I thought I had prepared well for the visit, but I had forgotten Shiloh's inmate number in the car. The car was away with my husband, who couldn't park on the premises. The officer grumpily reprimanded me. It was important to bring the number if I wanted to see someone. Otherwise, she said, she had to search through thousands of names. But then she asked, "What is his name?" It's a woman, actually, I said, and felt a shiver tussle my whole upper body. She answered, "Ma'am, for your information, this is a male prison. Everyone in here is male." I found it difficult to use Charlotte's legal male name, but though I felt intimidated, I managed to reply, "I know this is a male prison. Please search for Rodney Quine, but for your information, she is a woman." I went on to ask if she could kindly search for Kent, Charlotte's best friend and cellmate too, and if it would be okay for me to see him that day as well. To my surprise, she said, "Yes, ma'am. You can come out and walk back in here again and call for Kent later." She found Charlotte's inmate number and handed me a piece of paper with a passport photo of a woman with thick, long black hair to take with me to another building. I passed through a walk-through scanner and then several gates, waiting for each one to open and hearing a clang shut behind me. I found Compound A. The visitation room was filled with people. Half of them were wearing light blue shirts and loose dark blue pants stamped with Mule Creek State Prison in large yellow letters. Things felt strangely calm, except for the thumping of my heart inside my chest.
That's Kristen Lissigan, author of The Women of San Quentin, Soul Murder of Transgender Women in Male Prisons. Reading from the book, you're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. We're also joined by one of the women profiled in that book, Daniela Tavake. Soul Murder of Transgender Women is in the title. Kristen, what does soul murder mean, and where did that term come from?
Well, the first traces that I found of the term being used was from Sigmund Freud's subject. His name was Schreber, and he was writing about soul murder. And the other person at that time was a fellow Norwegian, the playwright Henrik Ibsen. And he explained that the the destruction mm-hmm. of life mm-hmm. and love in a human being. So it means, so my husband is a psychiatrist, child psychiatrist, and he helped me to find this title. And the term isn't used very much, but there was a psychoanalyst called, or he's called Schengold. And he wrote a book called Soul Murder, and he worked a lot about, child abuse and how you taking away somebody's life.
And a will to live and a will to be enjoy life.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excuse me. You also mention, I think it's in the book, that something about the high incarceration rates of transgender people and transgender people of color specifically. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it is, if we look at the population of people in prison in general, in the United States, then we know that there is a very, very high percentage of people, African-American men and other people of color. And so this is the same with transgender people. There is a high, very high percentage of LGBTQI people in general in prisons. And the explanation for that is poverty, racism, hate crimes. You know, people get, you know, 50% of all homeless youth in this United States are identifying within the LGBTQI.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to apologize. I'm going to sort of ask you two questions at once, Daniela. But you were in and out of prison a few times, and when you were released the last time, you had you know, what happened the last time you were in prison that changed how you felt and said, you know, I'm not going back?
I was finally me, and I was finally transitioning into the woman that I've always wanted to be. And the difference now from the three times before this time that I got released was I stifled myself. And I once believed that I could only be a woman and loved and respected as a woman and treated as a woman in prison. And once one believes that, their soul resonates towards where they can be that woman. And the difference now is I know who I am, and I really don't care what the next person thinks or says about me. And it may hurt, and it may make me want to punch them in their mouth, but the difference is I don't do all that, and I just allow the hurt and allow the disappointment to be processed and just move on.
And you're getting some help from some organizations in the Bay Area now?
Yes, I was helped originally from VRS and Service Connect, and it's in San Mateo County, and it's a work program where they give you an opportunity to work for 90 days and you build a resume either in catering or which is the restaurant business, and they teach you every aspect of the restaurant business, as in customer service, back of the house, front of the house, driving. I was the driver, and they teach you, give you training and warehouse work.
And so that's what you're doing now?
No, right now I work for Cheesecake Factory in Palo Alto.
Okay.
As a server.
Thank you very much. One last question before we go. Quickly, I want to ask, you mentioned earlier the, I think it was called the Transgender and Intersex Women in Prison Project or something like that. Did I get the name right?
It's Transgender Gender Variant Justice Project.
So that's a place people could go to find out more information.
Yes.
And I will try to get that organization name right and put it on our website, outonthebay.org.
Yeah.
Okay. Daniela Tavaki and Christine Lissigan, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kristen's book is The Women of San Quentin, Soul Murder of Transgender Women in Male Prisons. You can find information about the book online. Just search for the title, The Women of San Quentin. It's also available on Amazon, it's at Books Inc. and other Bay Area bookstores, and probably wider than that. If you missed part of our discussion or just want to hear it all again, it will be posted on our website, outinthebay.org, by about 8 o'clock this evening. Well, dear listeners, it's with some sadness, I must tell you, that Out in the Bay is going away, at least for a while. Marilyn Pittman and I have been producing this show for 11 years now.
Thanks so much for tuning in, folks. This is Preference. We hope to have Red on the phone. We're having a little trouble getting Red's connection to go through. I have some good news. Rare enough these days, but here it is. The Denmark Parliament has become the first country as of this year to remove trans people from a classification as mentally ill. First country in the world to do this. So we're going to see how that plays out in Denmark. Also, the Danish government has requested that the World Health Organization also remove transgender as a category of mental illnesses in its global classification dictionary for diseases and illnesses. So we'll see how that plays out. We also have... I'm going to hear another story. It's an interview with Dakota Salcedo about being gay and femme. This is from Radio Rookies, WNYC.
Before 18-year-old radio rookie Dakota Salcedo even knew he liked boys, other kids used to ask him if he was gay. He's always loved fashion, hung out with girls, and has a soft voice, so they just assumed. Dakota's gotten used to being an outsider among straight teenagers, but being femme can make acceptance tough, even among his gay peers. A warning, this story includes a term that may be offensive to some listeners.
I used to watch A Little Mermaid every day after school in my parents' room.
Wander and free, wish I could be part of that world. What would I
do? I wanted to be Ariel, so I could live in the sea, a place where I could just be me. When I heard my dad come home, I'd hide the tape underneath the bed. If he caught me, he'd say, Pa, eso sucio. Tú no ves eso. Tú eres un hombre. That's dirty. You don't watch that. You're a man.
We're really kind of trained from very early on as to how to, what we call, act like a man.
That's Manny Yonko. I took a workshop on masculinity with him last year.
Those words are not designed to be nice. They're designed to be hurtful and to be harsh, to slap us back in what we call the man box.
I've been wrestling with the man box my entire life. Manny says it's nailed together with misogyny and homophobia. Let me tell you, it wasn't easy when I came out to my family at 13. My mom, she was the last one to find out.
Everybody knew you were gay except me. To me, you were normal. Regardless of what you are, you're still my son, you're my baby, and I love you. And you should be proud of being gay. Right on, gay power!
You just broke my eardrums. So if you love me so much, why do sometimes you call me a faggot?
I really apologize. I really shouldn't. Sometimes I think about a lot of things. I say, you faggot, I get mad at you. It's a stereotype, and I apologize. Nobody should be called a faggot.
My mom doesn't want to hurt my feelings, so she says she accepts me. But calling me a faggot isn't very accepting. At school, it's worse. One time in English class, the only open seat was next to me. A student refused to sit there and sat at the teacher's desk instead. At my first high school, the bullying was just so bad. I had to switch schools. I guess if I change my mannerisms or start wearing my fringe purse, or my little tight jeans, I'd be more accepted. There are some things I can't change about myself, even if I wanted to. Like my voice. It isn't deep. We all know this. Some guys can be more masculine, depending on where they are. Like one of the advisors at my school, Mr. T. He's gay and keeps it a secret from the students.
Do you consider yourself masculine?
Yeah, I do.
In what ways?
In certain settings which I'm uncomfortable, I can kind of switch it on and off. Many people don't want to be outed. I can't wear like what I really want to wear to work, which I wear on the weekends.
Which is?
My God, labels. Like Oscar de la Renta.
Yes.
And, you know, Alexander McQueen, Ferragamo. I would love to wear that to work, but there's a time and place for everything.
Do you hate living like that?
Hate, no. Because I know that a little sacrifice kind of goes a long way.
Mm-mm. I'd rather die an outsider than sacrifice who I am. When I first met other young gay boys, I thought it was going to be easier, that I'd just be accepted. But it seemed a lot of guys just wanted someone who fit inside the man box.
Let me go on my Instagram. I'm coming across this picture.
Online? The masculine guys get all the attention.
This guy has his shirt off. Wow, look at his body. He has like an 8-pack. Oh, look, someone just commented, you look like a real man.
That picture got 100 likes
in only 4 minutes. Today I'm going to be interviewing a guy named...
Ricky.
My friend Ricky has over 2,000 followers on Instagram. He's handsome. He's masculine. Yeah, I said it. And he's out. Sort of. I have a confession to make. I low-key like him. Do you like masculine guys or feminine guys?
I think I like more masculine guys.
So, on a scale of 1 to 10, how masculine do you think you are?
7.
On a scale from 1 to 10, how masculine do you think I am?
5.
That's what it felt like. A shot to my heart. When he said that, I knew he didn't like me. I remember thinking to myself, smile and don't act like this is bothering you. I feel like a lot of gay guys are like that. Like, they only want masculine guys.
That's what I'm more attracted to. Like, if you're gay, obviously you're gonna like a man. Like, and somebody's feminine is more close to a girl.
Guys I have dated or talked to have treated me like I'm the female in the relationship. They pay for dinner, put their arm around me, and are more dominant. Like, they look down upon me. I asked Manny, you know, the guy who runs the Man Box workshop, if someone can be femme and be strong.
Absolutely. And, like, let me tell you something. It takes a lot of guts to be who you are in a world where people don't want to give you space for that, right? It takes a lot of power and strength to be authentic to who you are and not who people want you to be.
I don't want to change. Because in a lot of ways, that would take away the power that I have in being different. But the truth is, I get lonely. And not only for love. Finding male friends is tough too. A lot of guys aren't secure enough to hang out with the femme guy. They worry other men might think they're gay. So, for the first time in years, I'm trying to adjust. I've started going to the gym to get that more masculine look. I'm trying to put on some muscles to be more liked by the boys. I just want to be considered. Like Mr. T said, a little sacrifice goes a long way. But don't worry. I'm not giving up my French purse anytime soon. For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter Dakota Salcido.
Dakota's story was produced by Andrew Mambo of WNYC's Radio Rookies program. Kari Picton was the editor.
Radio, preference radio, KBOO. Thanks so much for listening. Red, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That's it'll work. It all works out. How are you doing?
Well, it's snowing really thickly, and it's a murderous winter wonderland.
So, I'm enjoying. I have my boss's car for the week, and I've never driven on snow in snow before in my entire life. So I'm not
You'll
too.
Be fine.
I hope so. fingers crossed. Where should we start? We should start with what's happening. Why don't we start with Backpage?
Okay, great. So as of last night, yesterday evening Pacific time, Backpage decided to close their adult services section voluntarily. They don't have to do this yet, even though they've been sued off and on for the past like 5 years. They just closed it down and put up a red censor button, and then they asked that people tweet the hashtag free speech, among other things, in order to protest what they're calling censorship. But really what it is, I mean, it is censorship, but it's also an attack on, like, sexuality, especially minority sexualities, and on sex workers under the guise of rescuing children from trafficking. So now, it's a free speech issue, but it's also, like, an economic issue and a women's rights issue.
So folks access ads on Backpage from all over the world, is that right?
Yes, but it's only in the states that they have shut down the adult services section, which is really great for my friends, you know, in Canada and Australia and wherever else. But it's in the states that they're having the issues with the, you know, Backpage is harboring trafficked minors. Although Backpage has actually been very cooperative with law enforcement and anti-trafficking orgs to hand over their records if they think any trafficking is happening. So they've cooperated really well with law enforcement.
And these concerns about trafficking in children is a wedge that folks use to go after sex workers over and over again. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's no data. There's no peer-reviewed, reputable data to support the idea that there's an epidemic of child sex trafficking or commercial child sex trafficking. There is data to support the idea that children are being abused in homes, and especially in foster care and the child welfare system. There's plenty of data to support that, but there's no underground group of evil men kidnapping little children to sell for sex.
Before we go into further, we should skip back and have you tell us a little bit about the work you do here in Portland.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, I have an outreach group, or really it's mostly just me, called Stroll, and I try to do outreach with street-based sex workers and with houseless people, which I'm really trying to step up since the weather has been so terrible and since two people died in the past week of the cold. So I go to a couple of the camps around town and I hand out, warm food and first aid kits and hygiene supplies.
That's great. So what's happening tomorrow?
Nothing is happening tomorrow because of the snow. It got rescheduled. There was supposed to be an anti-trafficking forum led by the CEO, or not the CEO, but the head of a local anti-trafficking organization that's very involved in rescuing women in order to put them to work in a garment factory. But because of the snow, it got rescheduled to January 30th.
So not too far off.
No.
We'll be on the air that evening, so I won't be able to join you. So what can folks expect, do you think, at this City Club forum on trafficking?
Well, I've been to a bunch of the last ones that he's been at, and I've testified against his bills in the Oregon.
Is your radio on?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it is.
Can you turn it off?
Yes.
No, it's not on.
Thanks. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, good. You were you're on a delay, so you were we go on the air delay, so you were recording. It was you recording over yourself.
Oh, okay. That sounds like me. I'm so confused.
So can you jump back a little bit? The question is, what can folks probably expect at this City Club forum on January 30th on trafficking?
So it's going to be the DA and Joel Shapiro, who works with Shared Hope International, the local anti-trafficking organization. And what they tend to do, what they've done in the past, is they take a lot of really racist stereotypes about women of color, trans women, et cetera. And then they, acrylic nails, hair weaves, those are all signs. They say that somebody is being trafficked. And then they use them, to build a case that somebody is being trafficked, and they describe how they use these clues. And then they also talk about how they've, in the past, used these clues to bully other people into testifying against a person who is a trafficker. It sounds confusing, but that's really because it is. They talked about how they had found a man who had a lipstick tattoo, and they badgered the tattoo artist under the threat of him being an accessory to trafficking into testifying that the person with the tattoo was a trafficker. So it's really convoluted, and it doesn't sound like... It doesn't really address trafficking. It doesn't address exploitation, but it is a really good way. You know, if you're going after people who have sex and saying that they're, because of that, they must be traffickers, it's a good way to get them, I guess.
Sure. And if I remember from last time you were with us, even carrying a condom is...
that too. Yeah, carrying a condom is evidence of trafficking, and they're using it as evidence of interstate trafficking because, and I'm quoting here, condoms are made in India, so they cross state borders.
Oy vey.
India is a country, by the way, but that didn't...
Brad, we have a caller, Rosie. I'd love to hear what Rosie has to say. Rosie?
Hi.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Okay. So
I'm interested in going to the city club on the 30th. Is that right? Is that the date that has been moved to?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I work in the adult industry. I consider myself a legal escort. I've been in the industry for a long time, and I'm glad that Red is on the air and that Kate is taking the time to talk about this issue because it's important. I have so many complaints about actually the Portland police and how they deal with women who work in the adult sport sex industry. I don't like to say sex industry because not everyone in the adult industry has sex. There's so many different parts of it. There's like laundry modeling, there's cam videos, there's like sugar daddy dating or sugar baby dating, and mm-hmm. then there's just so many things, and not all of it involves sex, and so that sort of bothers me. Anyway, I'm trying to narrow down the topic I want to focus on. I guess it has to be with the police, Portland police. I was arrested, and I actually was arrested twice for prostitution, but the first time I called the police because a customer pulled a gun on me. I had left the room unarmed without being shot, thank God, or killed. I called the police, and I told the police that someone had pulled a gun on me, and the police came, and they arrested me, and they also arrested the guy, but they dropped the DA. This was actually in a suburb of Portland. I won't give this up. Name, but the district attorney dropped charges against the guy, so the guy got no charges against him, even though he admitted to having a gun and to be unstable and to trying to scare me. I got the police, his police report and my police report, and so that was very devastating and traumatic for me. It was a very traumatic incident. I mean, besides having been traumatic, having to be arrested when I felt as though I was the victim, it just says so much. It says that my life is not valuable. I'm actually Latina also, so I felt it was very discriminatory. Like, if I were white, they would not have arrested me. It just says that the police don't value your life. Like, you don't have a right to call the police if someone's threatening you with a gun.
Yeah.
That was a very traumatic incident. And then I unfortunately said the wrong thing, the wrong words during an undercover sting operation in Portland. And so I was arrested, but that was very, they injured me when they arrested me for no reason. They put handcuffs on me way too tight, and I think they fractured my wrist. And that happened in front of an FBI officer, who was like a human trafficking FBI officer, sat there and watched the officer put handcuffs on my wrist way too tight. And I said, I actually have previous wrist injury, and the handcuffs are on way too tight. Can you please loosen them up? And the cop refused to, and I had the handcuffs on, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes. And then, let's see. I was interviewed at like near the police station by an FBI agent and then another undercover agent that worked with the police, and for about 5 hours. And I finally started complaining about my wrist being hurt, and they got nervous, and so they let me go, and they didn't press any charges. They gave me a phony citation to show up to court. But there was no court on the date that they gave me the citation for. Like, they just made up a date. And I called the court date, and I was going to go. But the clerk said that there's no court on Fridays at 1 p.m. ever under any circumstances. So it was clearly a phony date. And then they let me go. And then 2 months later, they issued a warrant for my arrest. And I had no idea. I had a warrant for my arrest because they let me go. There was a phony court date. I assumed they weren't going to press charges. And then 6 months later after that, I'd say like 7 months later after the undercover sting operation, I got stopped by police, and they told me I had a warrant for my arrest. and then I was before prostitution, and then I was arrested. But what I was, what the warrant was for, what they got a warrant for, was less off of the sting operation and more about my prior record for calling the police when someone pulled a gun on me. So it wasn't like I was. They based the warrant on my past history and not what happened during the sting operation. And that is really, from what I understand, and that is really troubling to me because...
Of course.
Because someone had a gun. I mean, I just feel like police are so corrupt. They just aren't...
Oh, definitely.
Trying
it's
to help.
It's really, really horrifying. I mean, it's horrifying what happened to you, but also the police are definitely corrupt. Like, I know that they were involved in covering up what was happening at STARS with the two minors, and it's just hard to have any faith when they're doing things like this and hurting people. You know, it's hard to take them seriously. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
There's one other topic I want to talk about. As part of me pleading guilty, I wanted to go to court, and I wanted to talk about how the police hurt me and all this stuff, but going to court is so, for prostitution especially, so humiliating. I would have done it. I kind of worked myself up to it, and I wanted to do it, but the public defenders, like, they knew that the police hurt me, and the public defender I had didn't want to help me. She wouldn't listen to me. I mean, it's kind of a joke calling them public defenders, and so I couldn't afford a regular attorney. And plus, I mean, my case, there was like an additional charge that didn't have to do with prostitution, with me getting kind of irritated
Rosie.
While they were interviewing me, so I was sort of aggressive. And
Rosie?
So, yeah. Anyway, so I had to go, as a part of my pleading guilty, I had to go to a counseling session with Now LifeWorks. They're there to help. And
Rosie, we need to wrap up your call. I'm going to ask Red to give out some information on connecting with sex worker activists here in Portland. So thank you, Rosie.
Thank you, Rosie.
Red, can you speak to that?
Yeah. So there's an organization called SWOC, the Sex Workers Outreach Coalition. We're doing an event for March 3rd, which is International Sex Workers' Rights Day, and we have meetings the second Wednesday of every month. They are at CAP, Cascade AIDS Project, and you can also look them up on Facebook. I think it's SWOC Flower, or facebook.com/SWOC Flower. And then you can look up Stroll on Facebook. It's facebook.com/StrollPortland or StrollPDX. I should know that. And then, you know, everybody's on Twitter too. Anything else I should hit?
No, but let's go back to Backpage. Real quick. The concern about Backpage is losing this site that people have used and I think feel some trust for. Is that right?
Yeah. It's not that Backpage is like a great site. You know, obviously they let people pay for ads yesterday knowing that they were going to shut themselves down. But they have been around for a long time, and they've been committed to fighting for free speech and the First Amendment, because what it comes down to is it's a First Amendment free speech thing. Third-party websites can't be held responsible for what other people say on them. You know, like, can you imagine if everyone was held responsible, if Facebook was held responsible for that crazy guy up in Seattle who wanted to, I don't know what they know about that, but I'm just getting sidetracked. So it's a First Amendment issue, and they've really gone to bat. They've spent so much money taking this to court and dealing with all of the trafficking charges that Kamala Harris keeps throwing at them, you know, despite the research and despite the fact that they work with law enforcement to curb trafficking and child sexual exploitation. So they've been around since Craigslist closed, really, or before that, but that's when they really got big, and they're pretty cheap. They're accessible to people who are poor and who would otherwise be forced to work the streets. And now that they're gone, a lot of people don't have enough money to advertise on the fancier websites, or they don't have fancier websites in their area. And a lot of people are going to be forced to work the streets now because there isn't anything else for them. A minimum wage in Portland doesn't even get you a one-bedroom apartment. I'm not even sure it gets you a studio now. You know, like, people don't have options. So
That's what it comes down to. Backpage was a really good option for a lot of people, and now it's gone.
Just to remind folks, City Club Forum moved to January 30th. Head to the City Club's website to get all the info on their forum on human trafficking, and you can attend. I don't know how that works with City Club.
It's free. You just show up.
Good, good. So get in there and say your piece.
Yeah.
If possible. Let's see. One last thing, Sarah Schulman is, we just have seconds left here, but Sarah Schulman's talking at the Seattle Central Library with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who's been on the show before. They'll be in conversation on Sarah Schulman's new book, Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty to Repair. Red, we're going to talk about that book and the ideas in it sometime in the future. I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. I can't wait.
I need to do my homework and read that book.
You're going to hate it.
she's actually on the short list of people I want on Preference. She's been on it for a long time. I followed her work since the days when she was a Kathy Acker type novelist.
Yeah, I really want to read the Gentrification of the Mind still, but this one, not so hot.
Yeah. Gentrification of the Mind is actually interesting. There's a lot pressed into it. I'm not sure it super hangs together, but it's certainly worth digging into. Red, thank you so much. We've loved having you.
Thank you for bearing with me and all my technology issues.
Sure.
Have a good night.
Thanks. All right. This has been Preference Radio. Thanks to Rosie for calling in as well. Thanks to David for keeping us running in the booth. Hard Knock Radio is up next. Here on KBOO.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. The reception is an opportunity to tour the exhibit, which illustrates the Black philanthropic experience, hear from exhibit creators, and connect with social justice movement leaders from across Portland. Again, that's the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of